WBCA Radio is proud to present City Talk, where fascinating conversation is alive and well, with your host, Boston radio veteran Ken Meyer.
You know, there have been many true crime books written over the years, but recently I came across one and said, oh boy, we got to do an interview on this one. Many of you may remember the Pam Smart case, which happened in 1991, when Pam was accused, along with her boyfriends, of murdering her husband. And a gentleman has written a prize-winning book, Stephen Zawicki, and the book is called Teach Me to Kill. And Stephen, I got to tell you, the minute I saw that, I loved it. But in reading your opening remarks, you didn't like it at first.
No, I didn't expect it to be so titillating.
Yeah, but it turned out that it was, because that's what grabbed me right away. And it was a good decision. I couldn't stop reading it once I got started. How did you get involved? I know you worked for People magazine at the time. How did you get involved in this case?
Well, you're right. I was a correspondent for People magazine in Boston. And, you know, it was a funny time. People magazine, I don't know if you remember, but at that time, a lot of focus was JFK Jr., Oprah Winfrey was a big subject, and Princess Diana. And the magazine had really started doing a lot more true crime. It was very attractive for the readers. And so we were doing more of that. There had been the Chuck Stewart case in Boston. There had been a number of other big cases. And so we were always on the lookout for them. And it heard a little bit of chatter about the Pam Smart case. But then Bob Holler, the Boston Globe, had done a piece about it, you know, kind of a summing up piece from New Hampshire. And he focused on this idea of Pam being the maiden of metal. When she was in college, she was a disc jockey who played heavy metal music. And really, that just caught my eye. And I sent a note to my editors in New York, and they said, go up to New Hampshire. And so I did.
So tell me, is truth stranger than fiction?
I think so. You know, it's funny with this case. Before I got the book, it was late in the fall of 1990. And we had done our piece, the first piece about the case, and we were coming up on the trial, which would be early the next year. And I talked to one of my sources and I said, you know, we're trying to talk to a publisher about this. Is this really as crazy as it sounds? He just said, every bit and more.
All right. Let's talk about the circumstances that started the whole involvement. How did Pam and Greg meet? I think through one of Pam's girlfriends, right?
Yep. They had gone to different high schools, and I think Greg was a year older. Pam went to Pinkerton Academy, which was in Derry, and Greg was one of the towns nearby there. And they met at a party, a New Year's Eve party, I believe it was. And I think you're right, a mutual friend. There was a Greg had a friend, Giraffe was her nickname. Her name's eluding me right now. It'll come back. But she was a mutual friend of both Greg and Pam, and she introduced them. Perry Chanel was her name.
And of course, it took off from there, and they got married. But even when they got married, it was kind of strange, because I remember talking to a friend of mine about this book. And I said, you know, one of the surprising things was that if they had an argument, Greg would throw beer in Pam's face. And he said to me, well, they made a movie and that was not in the movie.
No, that's true. The TV movie. That was one of the things I found out in the book that hadn't been widely reported. Greg, for the most part, was kind of a layback guy. He was a guy who was like, whatever, you want to do this? Whatever, I'll do it. He wasn't really that uptight. Pam was more the, you know, goal setting. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. He was also a kind of a ladies' man before he got married, and many girlfriends, many stories of his sexual exploits. And I think that he just when they clashed, he started, you know, the way he ordered was he just kind of got sick of it, and so he would do terrible things like that. I'm not saying he did it all the time, but I got at least two different people telling me that he had spit beer in their face. There was the one story you might be referring to is he. They were living in Florida at the time, and they were at a club, and she kept on arguing with him for some reason, and his way to answer that was to spit beer in her face, and the bouncer grabbed him and threw him out. And Greg's friend, I think it was Ted Chappelle, was begging the or Brian Washburn, one of those two, was begging the bouncer, oh, please let him back, you know, he won't do it again, it was just a mistake that he did it. And so the bouncer said, okay, they call him, Greg comes back, Pam and him start arguing again, and he does it again, and that's it, he's gone. So yeah, you're right about that.
How about the parents of the two individuals? How did they both feel about, I mean, how did Pam's parents feel about Greg, and how did Greg's feel about Pam?
I think at first they were both a little wary of different kids, but well, I'll start with Pam's parents. They were not crazy about Greg. He had long hair down to his shoulders, and I remember Mrs. Wojcicki telling me that she thought he looked like a girl. She was not impressed. He didn't go to college, and a matter of fact, before they were to get married, Greg's mother, Pam's mother, but certainly the parents, we're asking Greg's parents, how are we going to live? How is Pam going to live with this guy? Is he going to be able to help her live the way that she's used to? And I remember Greg's father was highly annoyed by that and said, don't worry about it. He'll be fine. And he was, he became a pretty successful insurance salesman following in his father's, in the line with his father. And, I don't think that Greg's parents had much problem with Pam. And I think, as a matter of fact, that Pam started to grow on Mrs. Smart. I know she said that, after they got married, they were living nearby one another, and they started to spend more time together. And Mrs. Smart said that she really started to like Pam very much.
When and how did this bizarre plot, if you will, start happening?
I would say in the I have to think when the murder occurred in June. So I think it was early in 1990 that M was working at Winneconnet High School for the school administrative unit, and she was a media teacher. And she had gotten to know Billy, and Cecilia Pierce was a key figure in this, and some of the other boys through a drug awareness program. And so Billy and his friends were just going to these meetings to check out girls. And they saw Pam, and I remember someone told me that Billy's response was, wow, she's hot, I'm in love. Never thinking that this would become anything more than that. All the boys, teenage boys, were very attracted to Pam and would kind of hover around her. And so that was how they first met. Then over time, Billy would come around flirting. And you know, as the story evolved, Pam would tell her intern, Cecilia Pierce, I think I'm in love with Bill. I always laugh when I say it because it sounds so corny, but that was what it was. And Cecilia's reaction was a lot the same to that. You know, this can't be true. But that's kind of how it got started, by Pam telling Cecilia that, and then Billy coming over.
What did she tell him to convince him that Greg was kind of a bad boy and that the marriage was not going anywhere?
Pam was telling Billy and Cecilia, she was saying that the marriage wasn't going well, that Greg had hit her. that he was not a good guy. So that was the message that was going to Billy. As a matter of fact, I think at one point he showed she showed them a bruise that from what she said was her hitting her. So that was kind of the message that they were getting. And I think it was just over time. I don't think it was all just once, but I think over time she would tell them that the marriage wasn't going well.
I mean, they tried three times before they were successful, if you will. Then, of course, it kind of goes with the old saying, the third time's the charm.
Billy didn't want to do it. The first time, it was almost out of the blue. I think this was in February. You know, don't hold me to the dates. But I think that it was in February. Pam just said, you know, they had been talking about it. And she said, now's the time. You know, go tonight. I'm going to be at a meeting. Go and do it. And Billy said, well, I don't have a gun. I don't have a car. Well, you know, you got time. Do it tonight. Billy just let it go. He didn't think she was serious. He didn't think it would be any big deal if he didn't do anything. But he was really shocked the next day when she was upset that he didn't go and do this. The next time, the second time, was with a kid named Raymond Fowler, who was the fourth teen involved in all this. Raymond got wind of this, and he said that he would go with Billy. And they got the key. Pam left the keys to her car in the parking lot while she was at an evening meeting. And they headed off for Derry from Seabrook out on the seacoast. And as they were going, Billy did not want to do it. And as they got closer and closer to Derry, he gave the wrong directions and they got lost. By the time they finally got to the condo where Greg was, he was already home. They were going to be lying in wait, but he was already home. So that was it. They couldn't. When Pam learned about this, she was furious. And that's it. You know, we can't be together if you're not going to do this. So the next time Billy got really serious about it. And for some reason, I can tell you the reasons why, but in a lot of ways, it's a mystery, probably even to them. Billy's closest friends, Pete Randall and J.R. Latimy, agreed to help him with this. And that led to the ultimate murder.
And who actually pulled the trigger?
Well, Billy. Billy, you know, the reason I hesitated was that there had been some, over the years, you would hear some of the defenders of Pam saying, oh, no, Pete Randall actually did it, and we have evidence of it. But no one has, what I've seen, any convincing evidence that it was anyone other than Billy. And certainly Billy's reaction on the witness stand, which is almost famous, where he broke down in tears describing this when it happened, point to him that he was very upset that he had done it.
One of the patterns that I find in reading some of these books is that the person who did it, and it's thought about by the police, she didn't really display the kind of reaction that they thought a grieving widow should.
You know, it's almost right from the beginning, there was that kind of reaction from the police. And I don't know that they were thinking that she did it, but right away, you know, in the very beginning, but they were kind of surprised by some of her reactions. I remember there was one incident where, okay, the condo has been cleared. You can go in and pick some clothing. And Pam went in and it was just grab a shirt, grab a tie, grab some pants, without even really giving any thought to it. And I remember Captain Jackson, who with the Derry police, said he was watching this and kind of raised an eyebrow and just looked at another officer. She was also very upset because there was fingerprint dust all over the white couch. And her reaction was, who's gonna pay for this? So that was kind of getting their attention. Later on, when Pam was moving out of the condo, there was a big blood stain from where Greg had been shot on the floor, and there was just a towel thrown over it. And some people mentioned that she would just walk over that towel without any. Most people said they wouldn't even go on in the condo, let alone have this kind of gathering of moving the stuff out So anyway, that was one of the things as well that caught people's attention.
The police were upset with her because she had a fascination with the press. They told her not to talk to the media, and she just turned around and did it anyway.
Am I going to college? She mentioned this to me when I talked to her, but said it elsewhere as well, that she wanted to be the next Barbara Walters when she was in college. She had wanted to be a journalist. She wanted to get into broadcast journalism, and she couldn't find a job doing that. So her job was as media coordinator for that SAU unit there at Winnicott High School. And Captain Jackson, I remember him telling me that one time he told her, look, you have to stop talking to the press about this. You know, it's not helping us. It's not any good. And he said her reaction was, don't talk bad about them. I'm one of them. So she claimed that she had a special affinity for the media. I think a lot of her attraction, especially Bill Spencer was a TV reporter at WMUR. She had called him a couple times to be interviewed. And at least once, but there are two famous interviews with her. I think she wanted to use the media to her purposes, to try to spin this case as a house, a break-in. Come upon a burglary.
Spencer is not at WMUR. Just out of curiosity, do you know what he's up to now?
You know, it's funny. Every once in a while, I'll Google people in the case, and I believe that he – I can't tell you what he's doing right now, but over the years, I have seen him continue to be a TV reporter in different cities around the country. I think Texas, but I might be wrong. But I have seen him around as he's still a TV reporter. But you're right, he's not at WMUR anymore.
Tell me how the police first got tipped off. I recall the name of Louise Coleman. How did she get involved and tip off the police?
Glad you mentioned her, because she was one of the heroes of this case that never really got enough credit, I thought. She had worked at Papageno's in Seabrook or in that area. And she was 39 years old. She was single. She was pregnant. And she had been at a gathering of a coworker. Cynthia Butts, I think, was her name. Cynthia Butts had worked with Cecilia Pierce. And Cecilia Pierce had confided in Cynthia that this is before the murder. I have a friend who was her, who she was an intern for, that wants to have her husband killed. She had told Cynthia Butts this. And Cynthia, I think, was 20 years old at the time, maybe 22, and she didn't think anything of it. She thought, you know, if this woman who wants her husband killed is telling a teenager this, it's probably not true. It's probably just talk. So she didn't do anything. But after Greg was killed, Cecilia was very upset, and she had forgotten that she had mentioned this to Cynthia. And so one day at work, Cynthia said, you know, what's wrong? And Cecilia's response was, oh, my friend's husband was killed, and it's just so sad. And she said, well, didn't you tell me that you had a friend who wanted to have her husband killed? And so what she did was she told her. She told her that this had happened. And Cynthia thought, well, this kid is telling me this, she's telling other people this, and I'm not going to get involved. That's the basic essence of it. A couple of weeks later, at a kind of a cookout, they got together for some beers over at Cynthia's house, and she mentioned this to Louise Coleman and some other friends. And I really admire Louise Coleman for this, because what she did is she got up, she walked back to her apartment, and she called the police. She called Dan Pelletier, and she told the whole story. But I always liked her last quote that she said to me. She said, all I could tell you is that I did my civic duty. And I thought that was great.
Yeah, you mentioned a name that I was going to ask you about. I think Pelletier is one of the heroes of this case.
Yeah, he was a lead detective on this case.
A lot of times, sometimes when you read a book, you'll find the police made a lot of mistakes. I know in Helter Skelter, Vincent Bugliosi had no problem in pointing that out. But it sounds like in this one, the police really did their job and were good at it.
I thought they did a good job. You know, there were some mistakes along the way. Day after the murder, and this wasn't the Derry police, but the state police had taken over the investigation, the immediate at home investigation. And they had a kind of a line of officers walked up the hill where Billy and Pete Randall had run away. It was a line search, and they were looking for any bits of evidence. And so they're walking up that hill, and there was a couple things they came upon. The key thing that they found was a glove. And that hill was near a medical facility, and they thought that the state police response was that glove came from it was just garbage. Well, it turned out later that glove was Billy had thrown it on the ground. He had been wearing it. And that was kind of a mistake. And I think there was a lot of people shamefaced about that because there could have been fingerprints on it. It would have certainly been corroborating evidence. So that was one thing that stuck out.
Take a couple of minutes, if you will, and tell us about how all these people eventually got arrested and charged with the crime.
Well, there was Louise Coleman that set them on the trail to paying more attention to Pam Smart and Cecilia Pierce. So in order to get Pam's involvement, to prove that Pam was involved with this, they had Cecilia, and this was after some resistance from Cecilia and her family. They did convince Cecilia to go in with a body wire. In a large part, that was a big part of the trial. That was where Pam particularly was admitting that she did it. She was trying to convince Cecilia to not go to the police, to not tell the truth when she was asked any questions by the police. Eventually, the boys were arrested early in in June of 1990, and that case that had broken how that all came down. Oh, okay. Ralph Welch was a friend of JR and Pete Randall. And he had been one of the toughest kids of that bunch. These were the friends of Billy Flynn's. And he lived with J.R. Latimy. He lived with that family. But he had been separating from those kids more and more. He had a girlfriend, and he was changing. And so he wasn't involved in this murder. But he came home one day, and he told Pete Randall and J.R. Latimy, they were in the bedroom, and he said he had been hearing some rumors from some friends in the neighborhood that Billy was talking about having murdered Greg. And he wanted to know if these guys knew anything about it. And they said, oh, no, that's not true. That's just a story. That's not true. And Ralph Welch accepted their story. But he left the room, and he went back, and he listened at the door. And he heard them say, you know, if he knows about this, you know who's next. And he thought that meant that they were going to try to hurt him. Long story short, he went to JR's parents about this. There had been a fight. Pete Randall beat him up. But he went to JR Latimy's parents about this. The father then, the parents then went to the police in Seabrook, and they brought in the gun, the 38 caliber handgun. And that basically led to this whole thing breaking open. The boys were arrested shortly thereafter, and we went from there.
There is also a scene in there that you describe when the police were convinced that Cecilia Pierce knew more than she was telling. and he really laid her out in lavender, as they say.
Oh, that was a good story. Yeah, he appears was fighting in herself. She was devoted to Pam, but at the same time, there was, this is what she had said, Greg was dead, and she didn't really know what to do, but she was sticking loyal to Pam. And the police had called her in. Now they were on to Cecilia, and they kept trying to get her to talk about it, and she wasn't. And Captain Jackson had just been a viewer in this meeting. This meeting was run by Dan Pelletier and Detective Charowitz, and they were basically calmly asking him questions, asking her questions. And Cecilia would, she was just kind of like, she would look at her watch, she would look up at the ceiling. It was like she had no interest in this whatsoever. And Captain Jackson jumped up and he said, "I've had enough of this." And he basically said, "Don't think that we won't charge you with this if you're, you know, trying to block an investigation." And he really scared her. He was upset. He was yelling at her. Now, when I talked to Captain Jackson, he said it was all an act. He said it was all part of his plan. But when I talked to Cecilia's mother, who was there at the time, she thought it was how he was really feeling. The funny thing about that is he gets mad and he starts yelling at Cecilia. And Cecilia's mother sees this, and she gets up. She's the protective mother, and she starts yelling at him. And he takes her out in the hall, and he says, "You know, this was just an act. I was just trying to get her to take this serious." So that's how that went down.
Did Cecilia have any problem in going in with a body wear, because she did it more than once?
I think she did have some resistance to it. They did have some resistance initially. And I know that there were members of her family who did not want her to do it. They thought it was too dangerous. I'm not sure it was even necessarily her mother and stepfather, but I know some of the aunts and uncles did not want her to do it. You know, they had a lot of fears for her. But when she went in, she was actually pretty good at it. She, I always said, you know, she went in and, she was not nervous. She told the story pretty well. She kind of laid the things out for Pam to talk about. And I remember at the end of one, she just goes, so Pam gets out of the car and Cecilia just says, "Yow." She just kind of I think she enjoyed doing it in that sense.
All right. They obviously all had attorneys. Tell us about both the prosecutors and the attorneys for the defense.
Okay. Well, the prosecutors were Paul Maggiotto and Diane Nicolosi. It had originally been another prosecutor. I think Cynthia White was the original for this, but she dropped out, and Paul Maggiotto, he hadn't been in New Hampshire very long. He had come from Brooklyn, and I had seen an interview with him where he talked about he was comfortable. He had done, I think, 9 murder cases before this one, and he's relatively young guy, but he was comfortable with the media, and he had no problem with doing that. So he was the lead prosecutor for that. Diane Nicolosi, she had less experience, but I thought she was a very valuable part of that prosecution team. She was understated. Maggiotto was more confident and out there. Diane Nicolosi, I don't even think she granted me an interview, but she was very good as far as working with Cecilia. Cecilia could be difficult. I mentioned she kind of had that attitude of, oh, kind of this annoyed attitude that a teenage girl might have under some stress. So she was very good at working with Cecilia. I thought that was a very good team. Diane, when she was on, addressing the jury, I don't think she was as confident, but I thought she was pretty effective. It was a very understated approach that she took. The defense was Paul Toomey and Mark Sisti. Mark Sisti still represents Pam, as a matter of fact. Paul was more, I mentioned in the book that he seemed more like the college professor type. He was, everyone likes Paul. Paul had a great sense of humor. I'll tell you a funny story about him in a little bit. But he never took himself too seriously. But he was very good. Both of them were a very good defense team, highly regarded in New Hampshire. Sisti was more of kind of the pit bull. One of the attorneys I talked to who knew him said that he felt that sometimes Sisti could even intimidate the judge in some cases. So that was that pairing. They had been around. They had been in the public defender's office for a while before they started their own firm. When Pam went looking for a defense attorney, this was before she was even arrested, they had come highly recommended.
How about the judge?
Judge Gray. He was known as the hanging judge in the New Hampshire prison system. He's kind of an intimidating guy, very tall. There was no messing around in his courtroom. I saw somewhere Paul Toomey said he liked him very much. So I think he was well respected.
And how long did the trial last?
With the actual work of it started around March 5th, testimony, and then the 2nd was the of 1991 was when the verdict came down.
It was televised. Should it have been?
There's a lot of arguments about this and discussion about it. I felt that overall that was a good thing that it was, coming from media perspective, to get that information out there. Some people felt that it wasn't, that fictionalized the case, that showed these young people who, although they were certified as adults, they were still young on television to everyone. I thought for the most part it was okay. I didn't see how it affected the jury in any way.
And tell us now about the verdicts and what they were for each individual.
The boys had signed plea deals in exchange for their testimony. And Pete Randall and Billy Flynn had 28 years, were sentenced to 28 years. I might be right about this, but Vance Latimy, I think, had... Raymond Fowler had less. I don't remember what he Pam ended up getting life in prison without the possibility of parole. The biggest charge for Pam was accomplice to murder. There was witness tampering was another charge as well. But basically she got life without parole, and that was mandatory in the state of New Hampshire.
And she actually admitted it on tape to Cecilia Pierce.
That was one of the, it's funny. I made copies of those tapes from the line feed at the trial, and I listened to them extensively. And there was that line where Pam said to Cecilia, "If you go and you you tell the truth to the police, I'm going to end up in the effing slammer." She knew.
Yeah. Give us an update now on these people, when they got out, that did get out, and what they've been doing, and reactions to people in New Hampshire.
Raymond Fowler, he was released in 2003. Now, Raymond Fowler was just he had come along for the ride. He had gone on the first time to say, talked about that he had gone with Billy on the second attempt. And the thought was that he just wanted to try to get a free stereo or get anything that he could steal, that he had no intention of Bill and Greg of being involved in a murder. And really, when it was the actual murder, he had just gone to keep JR company. JR wanted Ramey to come because he just, while he was waiting. Latimer, who drove the car and provided the gun, got out in 2005. He was paroled. And let's see, Billy and Pete Randall were finally paroled in 2015 after they served 25 years, and they had time for a good time. Now, what they're doing since then, Billy married while he was in prison. I haven't followed it very closely over the years, but I've always paid attention to it. He was married while he was in prison, and the judge, when he was granted his parole, the judge suggested that he stay away from the media and he just get on with his life. And as far as I know, he has. He's turned down many media requests. There was a reporter in New Hampshire who went up and talked to him briefly and took a picture of him all the while that he was saying that he didn't want to talk to her. That was the only kind of anything close to an interview that I saw after he got out of prison. Really, I haven't heard anything about Pete Randall or J.R. Latimer. Fowler had been in trouble now and then. There were a couple incidents that he had been involved in, but nothing big. So I think that was basically it. Cecilia Pierce, who went in with the body wire, she left the state. Her mother moved the family to Missouri, where they had relatives after the trial. And I'm not sure how they were long, how long they were gone, but Cecilia eventually came back. She's a registered nurse, and she had been involved in animal rescue work in New Hampshire. I don't have the most recent update, but I remember seeing that.
Have you tried to contact any of these people after they got out?
I've thought about it. I thought that might be a interesting book after Pam Smart. But no, I haven't. Really, it was kind of sad in a lot of ways. I lost touch with a lot of people involved in the case there who I had gotten to know. So I really didn't have a lot of firsthand information about them.
The tabloid shows, from what you tell in the book, they had a ball with this case.
Well, the Boston Herald was a big one that covered it. I remember some of the headlines describing her as the ice princess. And then some of the National Enquirer and Weekly World News, I don't know if that paper is still around, but they had done stories on it. I always laughed about the Weekly World News. That was a tabloid. It wasn't like an actual newspaper, but they had all these kind of crazy stories. You used to see them at the checkout line. And it was, you know, President Bush meets alien from Mars, that type of thing. And I always laughed because they did a story about the Pam Smart case, and it was 100% accurate. It was beautifully written. And I thought every other story in this paper is crazy, and the Pam Smart story is absolutely accurate.
Now, you got to talk with her. And this is, I don't know, kind of a hard question, but what were your feelings toward this woman? I mean, she talked somebody into committing murder.
If you don't mind, let me just lead up into that. I was doing my story for People, and I talked to Pam's mother on the phone. And I said, is there any chance that Pam would be interviewed while she's awaiting trial? And she said, oh, that wouldn't be possible, but why don't you send her a Christmas card? And maybe when this is all over, she'll talk to you. And so I sent her a Christmas card, and I always laugh because it was a golden retriever in a red pickup truck with a Christmas tree in the back. And you open it up and it said, happy holidays, they're headed your way. And a friend of mine said, that was so cruel to send to somebody in prison. And I said, well, it was just kind of one of my Christmas cards that I was just sending. But anyway, I sent her a Christmas card, as Pam's mother suggested, with a note. And I just said, I realize the situation here, and but if you want to talk, you can call me Collect, and I'd be glad to talk to you. And not long after that, she did call me at home, and we talked. I've said this before. I liked Pam. She's very likable. At this time, she was talking about the case. I would never have, I hate to use this term, but I will. I would never have an affair with a 15-year-old, a 16-year-old. That's crazy. And that was the whole kind of line of that interview. And then when the boys were finally certified as adults, she changed the tune and she said, yeah, well, you know, I did have an affair with Billy. But I liked her. I thought that she, it was funny. She could talk about, I asked her about Greg and I asked her about Billy. She talked about Greg. I always felt that she was kind of talking almost, it was almost like a Hallmark greeting card kind of way that she was talking about him. I didn't really sense any connection or, but when she talked about Billy, it was like she was talking about her best friend. I mean, it was really, she obviously liked him very much, even though while she was talking to me, she was denying that she had any relationship. She would just say, oh, he was such a sensitive kid and he could tell you the most personal things. So that was kind of my impression talking to her at that time.
Tell me, are Pam's parents still alive? I know that the Smart parents are not. They have both passed away. The father died of pancreatic cancer, I know, in 2010. I can't remember what happened to his wife, but I know she passed away earlier than that. What about Pam's parents?
I haven't really kept in touch, but just obviously looking at the news, I've seen Mrs. Woe just quoted extensively. I wouldn't be surprised if you got a call from Mrs. Woges after this interview airs. She has, she and the family have done many interviews, not the family, but friends, supporters of Pam have done many interviews. And I did an interview, this was back many years ago in Florida, I think it was. And they called in. We finished the interview and I got called back by the host and he said, could you come back? Pam Smart's mother is on the phone and she wants to debate you about this. So I did have a conversation with her at that time. And I always remember because she's criticizing me and attacking me. And one of the callers called in and just said, did you ever read Mr. Swicky's book? Oh, I don't need to.
Yeah.
And I thought I was very nice to her in the book. I felt badly that she had been through all this. She was so devoted to Pam, I think to the point where she doesn't see the truth. Mr. Woges, I got a kick out of him. I don't know what his feelings were about this. He didn't believe that she could ever do anything like this. And he told me he wouldn't believe that she would do something like this until she outright told him. But I liked him because he had a real sense of humor about him. I remember he said to me, well, I know one thing. She didn't do this for the insurance money, because if she wanted insurance money, she would have took care of me.
Now, there's also a point that I just remembered in the book, where the police actually went to Greg's parents or Greg's father and asked for help before the trial and everything.
Captain Jackson talked to Bill Smart and he said, you know, we need somebody just to kind of pay attention to her moods and what she's doing and what she's feeling and how she's reacting to events. And we can't get close enough that way. But you and Judy, Mrs. Smart, are talking to her on a regular basis. So could you keep us informed on this? Part of that deal, and I don't know how formal it was. It was just kind of pay attention to them for us. But part of that was that they didn't want Judy, when she learned that the boys who knew Pam were somehow involved in this, wanted to come right out and ask Pam, you know, what's going on here? How do you know them? And Bill Smart kept on telling her, you can't say anything. You know, we have to be calm about this. We have to not, you know, show our hand on this. And finally, one day, Bill wasn't home, and Judy did. She said, you know, how could these boys, you know, who know you but didn't know Greg, be involved in this? She did push it a little. Another funny story is they went out when they first learned the boys were involved. You know, Bill Smart, I think he drove a Jaguar. And they decided to drive out to Seabrook to see where all these kids lived. They went out to where Billy lived. They found Billy's address, and they kept driving by the house. And they looked, and they said, I don't know how they knew this, but they said that there was an unmarked police car that had been following them. And they just kind of laughed that they weren't really the big investigators that they thought they were.
Do you have a profound respect now? Do you think differently of the police department than you did before this whole thing occurred?
You mean the Derry police in particular?
Yeah.
I don't think I had any lack of respect before. I was impressed by the way they handled this whole case. So I don't think that changed very much. One of the things that I thought was noteworthy is trial. They weren't really, you would think that the defense attorneys would go after the police. You get them on the stand and try to break their credibility. And they didn't. Dan Pelletier was so well respected and so likable that I don't think that they wanted to go after him.
And are these guys? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I think even the defense respected them.
Are any of these people still active that were involved in the case? Is Pelletier still working?
I believe that he has left the police department. So no, I don't think so. Captain Jackson, who kind of oversaw this case, he passed away a number of years ago. Paul Maggiato in the prosecutor's office, I think he was a defense attorney in New Hampshire in private practice. Paul Toomey, I don't believe, is still a practicing attorney. I think he may be retired. But I know Mark Sisti just recently represented Pam. They were trying to get Pam to have a commutation hearing, which was denied. But he still representing her after all these years, more than 30 years.
Should she be released?
Well, there's some argument about that. You know, I saw a good interview with Paul Maggiato, or I read it, and he said, you know, he was a prosecutor. He said, I take away someone's hope. And life without parole does take away someone's hope. So, I you know, that struck me. It struck me coming from him as well. I don't know that she should be released. I think that's a question of mercy for the for governor and the state of New Hampshire. But at the same time, she's never accepted responsibility for this. You'll see an interview now and then where she says, I've accepted responsibility. If it wasn't for me, this never would have happened. What she was saying is, if I didn't get involved with Billy, who, by the way, was 15 years old when this began, this never would have happened. You know, Billy never would have done this if he hadn't fallen in love with me and we hadn't had this, quote, affair. But the truth is, she's not admitting her part in it. She's just saying, yeah, I was there, but I didn't, you know, I was involved with Billy, but I had nothing to do with this murder. He did this on his own, which is so far from true if you just listen to the tapes.
Now, you are in the Ohio area currently. What have you been doing since all this occurred?
Well, I did two books after the Pam Smart book. I spent a year at Angel Memorial Hospital. I'm sure you know them there in Boston.
Yep.
The book was called Animal Hospital. That got a lot of good reviews, and it did pretty well. And then I did another book called Bomb Proof with a woman who had a seizure alert dog and named Bronson. And she had been through a lot of stuff in her life. And this seizure alert dog, who had been trained in a prison, saved her life and basically changed her life. So I did two books since then. I have done a lot of business writing in the last 10 years or so. Covering the executive search industry was one place we did, one area we covered. So that's basically it. I'm getting back now more into more freelancing. I have a few ideas for articles and for book projects.
Well, I'll tell you, if what you write is anything like the Pam Smart book, you're going to have another winner. Because I've read a lot of true crime books, and that's got to be one of the best, I think, that I have ever read. You can't put it down. And I hope that people will read it and form their own opinions. And I want to thank you for taking time to come on the air and talk about this. I think it's a landmark book.
Thank you, Ken.
So thank you very much for being a guest on the program. And who knows, maybe we'll talk again.
Okay, that'd be great.
All right. And that will do it for this edition of City Talk.
Thanks for listening to another great conversation with Ken Meyer and friends. You can contact Ken by email. The address is kjmeyer7@gmail.com. That's kjmeyer7@gmail.com. Tune in next time for more conversation with Ken Meyer on City Talk.